Radium therapy is the beginnings of the ways that we use radioactivity in medicine today, like modern radiotherapy. A lot of it comes from radium therapy and the ways that we use medical radioisotopes and other radiation in medicine today. A lot of those techniques came from radium therapy or came from physicians who were using radium therapy and then adapted that later in their careers when they began using radioisotopes in the 1940s or 50s.
And welcome to My Nuclear Life. I'm Shelley Lesher. Today I'm speaking with Amy Slaughter, who earned her PhD in the history of science, technology, and medicine at the University of Minnesota. She combined all of these research areas in her thesis on radium therapy before World War II and the influence physicists and chemists had on its standardization as an acceptable form of cancer treatment in a hospital setting. The scientific community knew about cancer for centuries, dating as far back as the ancient Greeks. But it wasn't until the 19th century, with the development of anesthesia, that surgery and the radical mastectomy became routine. But while cancer treatment improved, hospitals were still viewed as a scary place for the general public, and most of them avoided hospitals and doctors as well. Not to mention, cancer was a taboo subject. But what if there was a new treatment which did not require surgery? What if you read in the paper it could cure your child's blindness or give you extra energy? Would you go to the doctor then? According to Mayo Clinic, more than half of all people with cancer receive external radiation therapy as part of their cancer treatment. It can be used as a primary treatment or in combination with other treatments, but we know it is a powerful tool in treating any type of cancer. What we now think of as standard cancer care has its roots in a miracle cure from the early 20th century. To help us understand how the fantastical became routine and the role scientists played in that conversion, Amy Slaughter sat down and entertained my questions. To begin, I wanted to know why, as a historian, she chose to study radium and its medical applications.
As a historian, I'm really interested in radioactivity, and I'm especially interested in how radioactivity and people meet, and medicine is one of those places. Since its discovery, people have been interested in radioactivity. It's this weird, magical, sometimes dangerous thing, and has a lot of popular attention, but it's one of those things that people know about but rarely get the chance to interact with. And medicine is a place where people who aren't scientists like experience it directly sometimes.
What I found fascinating is that in today's world, people are very kind of scared of radioactivity. And we try to hide it in our hospital procedures. But when it was first discovered, you mentioned that people saw this harmfulness as hope.
Yes. The first times that people found that it had an effect on the body were accidental burns. So Pierre Curie or Henri Becquerel or others were carrying, you know, tubes of radium in a jacket pocket or something like that and found that it had burned their skin. And rather than that being as a sign of like, oh, this is horrible, we should have nothing to do with it, it's, oh, this has an effect on the body. Can this have a beneficial, like, can we use this for good? Can we use this in medicine?
What was the medical scene like at that time that there was so much hope in this kind of miracle cure?
There was a lot of hope put into radium, especially with cancer. Cancer was growing as a cause of death in America. And as people were getting infectious diseases under control, things like heart disease and cancer were becoming more of a concern popularly. And basically, the only treatments for cancer at the time, this is the beginning of the 20th century, was surgery. And this is a time when hospitals are beginning to modernize. So the average person might still have a lot of anxiety about going to the hospital because there's a sense from a slightly older period that it's a place where you go to die, that there might not be anything that they can do for you. And cancer was very scary and people didn't talk about it. So people a lot of times would put off going to the doctor if there was something that they were afraid might be cancerous. And that didn't help your chances with surgery. The earlier you detect cancer, the better your chances are for having a good prognosis. And the hope for radium was that you would both have another way to treat cancer in addition to surgery. And also, since it didn't seem as scary as surgery, you didn't have to go under the knife, you didn't have to be made unconscious in the hospital, that it could encourage people to go to their doctor sooner. So that even if that particular patient didn't end up getting radium therapy, they'd already been diagnosed earlier, and then they'd have a better chance of having a successful outcome from surgery.
Do you think that changed as the fear of surgery decreased as the years passed?
Yes. Yeah, I think that that changed, definitely, because people were becoming more comfortable going to hospitals, and surgery was improving, and the recovery rates were getting better, and hospitals were becoming more modern and scientific.
So do you think that radium helped hospitals become more modern and scientific in a way?
Yeah, they were definitely part of this modernizing and scientific process, was bringing radium into hospitals, bringing things from the laboratory, like radium, like x-rays, like electrotherapy, which is not a thing anymore, but it was at the beginning of the 20th century. It was bringing cutting-edge science into the laboratory where physicians could use it.
So let's go back. When was radium discovered and what made it different than other known elements? Because uranium, thorium, and polonium were already known at the time. So what made it different?
Right. So radium was discovered in 1898, along with polonium, by Marie Curie and Pierre Curie. And radium was the most radioactive substance known when it was discovered. And it had to be refined laboriously out of uranium ores or other ores containing radium. So it wasn't something that you could mine out of the ground the way that you could mine uranium. You had to process it and take tons of material to turn into grams or micrograms of radium. So it was very difficult to come by, but even a small amount of it was very radioactive. So it was really remarkably radioactive.
And the people in the press kind of went nuts when they found out about it, right?
Yeah, so in America, and starting in around 1903, there was this period called the radium craze, which lasted for 4 or 5 years as real height of interest. It lasted for a while, but there was really a concerted period from 1903 to around 1907 when the American press was just really fascinated with radium. And what was it? What could it do? There was this sense that scientists were always discovering more things about it, but there were still more mysteries discover. And so there was all this room for speculation and wild headlines, all of this wild speculation about what radium could do.
What were some of the really out there claims?
Some of it was talking about the radioactivity, and some of it was talking about what we now understand as nuclear energy, that the radioactivity seemed to be breaking the laws of the conservation of energy, which people knew and believed in. Like, you can't get energy out of nowhere, but you have a little speck of radium and it's always giving off heat. It's always giving off these radioactive waves, whatever they are. And it's not taking in anything, but it's always putting stuff out. It's always putting energy out. So it seemed to be breaking conservation of energy. So there was a lot of speculation that if you could get all that energy all at once, then we could lift the British Navy a mile into the air, which is sort of getting into early imaginings of atomic bombs, of unlocking the energy of the atom. But there were also things about, like, we could use radium to heat our homes, just using the heat from the element itself. We could use it for lighting, all sorts of things like that. And there were also, it was so popular that people would make cartoons just riffing on what radium could do. And it was also very popularly known to be very expensive. So this was sort of like what rich people can do with radium. So it's like you go to the opera and all of the society ladies, you don't have to have lights, you know, lighting the aisles anymore because their jewelry will light the hall and that will be enough for them to see by and things like that.
What's interesting here is that in the newspaper, they're actually talking about real science.
Yes. Yeah. And some of it is based off of reports that scientists have put out, and some of it is real, just speculation, very far removed from the source material.
How would they denote the rays? Like, how would they denote in pictures? You said that they would draw the radium. How would a person know that it wasn't just a rock?
Right. So they'd have like little shining lines coming out of it. So like little lines, like a halo, like starlight, like sunlight sort of radiating out of it, these little lines coming out of it. And so it also kind of That's the glow that if you have radium salts, which is how most people, if there wasn't a radium, would be in a salt form. And that actually does glow green in the dark. So you sort of have those lines denoting that also.
So it's still the way that we would draw it now. That imagery has kept with us all these years later.
Yeah.
Let's move on to what are called radium therapists.
Radium therapists are doctors who use radium in their practice at the beginning of the 20th century. I specifically looked at America, but there were radium therapists across the world that were using radium.
They were real doctors that were treating someone with radium like they would a surgery.
Yeah, correct. Some of them at the beginning of the 20th century would be homeopathic doctors, because this is during a period when homeopathic doctors were more of an option. I mean, you still see a homeopath today, but they were more of an option for people in the early 20th century, because allopathic doctors, what we think of, but mostly what you mean when you meet a doctor today, were still professionalizing and establishing themselves as like, this is medicine, this is what it means to be a doctor. One thing that homeopaths at the beginning of the 20th century were interested in radium because they believed in the idea of treating like with like. So if you took whatever was injuring that person or hurting that person and you took a very small amount of it, then you could use them to treat like with like. So the same way that you could use radium in a very small amount to treat some sort of ailment that had something to do with energy or burning.
Okay, so you would treat a burn with burn?
Yeah, in a small amount. That was the philosophy.
Okay. You mentioned that it was expensive. So was radium treatment expensive too?
So there was definitely a perception that radium treatment was expensive, because radium was, if you read the newspaper, you knew that radium was the most expensive substance, like per weight, on Earth. Like there was, you couldn't buy anything more expensive. So it was difficult for doctors to get a hold of. And they, of course, would have to charge patients to make up the cost of the outlay that they had to do to buy the radium. But it was not, despite the popular perception that it was only a treatment for people who could afford it, that was not strictly the case. There were hospitals and private practices that had a sliding scale available, so that if you could not afford the treatment, the provider would provide the treatment to you for free or for a reduced cost, and then would charge patients that were well off more to cover the cost of patients who couldn't afford it. But that, of course, is assuming that that patient lived near a hospital or a provider who had radium. So since radium was expensive, it was also scarce, and most people didn't have it. So if you wanted to get radium treatment, or if your physician wanted to recommend you to get radium treatment, you'd have to go to a place where there was, which was mainly cities on the East Coast, in like the Northeast for the most part. You would have to incur travel expenses for a lot of patients. So it was just out of the reach, I think, of a lot of patients in the U.S.
In the early days, there was internal and external radium therapy. Is it as obvious as it sounds?
For the most part, it gets a little bit complicated as you go on, but mostly internal radium therapy is eating, drinking, or having radium injected into the patient. And external radium therapy is using usually radium salts at the beginning of the 20th century externally. So some of the areas they were mainly focusing on were things like skin conditions, including skin cancers, and also gynecological cancers, because you could reach those externally with the radium salts. So if you had an internal tumor, initially, it was harder to get the radioactivity to that without damaging the tissue in between.
So one popular method was William Morton's liquid sunshine treatment. As a nuclear physicist, I cringe just reading that, but at the time it was popular. So could you explain what that was and what were the perceived benefits?
Yes, it was popular. I don't know how many people actually underwent the treatment. He was very good at self-promotion. So he was definitely in the news, but I don't know like how popular it was as far as the number of people treated. But the idea of liquid sunshine therapy was drawn from sunshine therapy, which was a thing in the progressive era with the idea of being out in the sun is healthful. It's good for you. This is when they started having like lots of recess for kids and having school outside in the sun, and it's good to be outside in the sun. So William Morton took that theory and said, well, if the sun is good for you outside, then the sun must be good for you inside also. And radium is often likened to the sun because it gives off energy and light. So the idea would be that you would drink or be injected with a radium solution and then somehow activate it by exposing the patient to x-rays or some way to activate it so that the inside of you was fluorescing. That was the idea. To the point where another doctor, who at the time, a contemporary of his who was upset with this therapy, took some lab animals in a public experiment and said, I'm going to give them my version of this liquid sunshine therapy and then draw their blood and demonstrate that it does not fluoresce. Even if we assume that this is good, it's not doing what he says it's doing.
So hopefully that went away pretty quickly?
Yeah. But beginning in 1913, there was an American radium industry. So there were companies producing, like mining and refining radium in the United States. And the major company there was called Standard Chemical. And they wanted to, of course, promote radium therapy. And they wanted to promote internal radium therapy because that was slightly more affordable. And they also thought there was room to expand that market. So they were definitely still promoting, like drinking radium water, inhaling radon, and occasionally, you know, injections of radium from your doctor. They were doing research along those lines and trying to promote those as avenues of medical research into the 1920s.
Is this when you see all those products coming on the market where, you know, radium-laced, I think the favorite one of mine is radium-laced chocolate and radium-laced contraception and radium-laced
toothpaste and makeup and all sorts of things. It gets complicated because radium is so popular that a lot of products put radium in the name, but there's not actually any radium in the product itself. They're just using it as a marketing device. So you don't have no idea as a consumer if you're going and buying radium lipstick, which I think was available in France and not in the United States, if that had any radium in it or not. So as a consumer, you probably did want some radium. From the perspective of hindsight, it's probably good that a lot of those products didn't have any radium in it. So there definitely were products that you could buy that were radioactive. There were many products that you could buy that claimed that they were, that weren't, that were just using it for the marketing buzz. But definitely, if you wanted radium therapy at home and you didn't live near a radium therapist, or you were just wanting it for sort of general health, you could buy a radium jar or a radium invigorator. So it, like a ceramic container, and the ceramic, the clay that they've used to make the ceramic has basically the tailings left over from processing radium. So it was a way for the companies that were processing radium to use mining tailings, which otherwise they can't make any money from, to make ceramics. And it does make the water slightly radioactive. And especially in places in Europe where hot springs were part of a spa treatment and a healthful way of life, the discovery that hot springs are naturally radioactive, some people saw that as like, oh, this is why hot springs are helpful. This is why it helps my arthritis. This is why it helps whatever, is because it's radioactive. So bringing home waters from spas, people have done for forever. And now they had, like, it seemed like a scientific reason to do so. And being able to do it at home with a radium water emanator could give you those benefits. I have to double check. And I think that you'd probably have to be drinking a heck of a lot of water for that to have any negative effects. Like the amount of radiation was so slight. I don't think that they were doing any unknowingly doing any health damage to themselves.
One company was the Revigorator, who recorded this little ditty to sell their product.
Find the health you're looking for with the Grand Revigorator. The power of radium will help you to become quite vigorous. Your water's wilted, it's the truth. So you need this fountain of youth. Prime it up every day, drink your disease away, and be robust. The shadow of a doubt upon the water that you drink, removed by the Revigorator, it puts you back in the pink. Radioactivity makes you feel oh so healthy, you'll never grow old. Yes, and you'll feel bold, and you'll thank us for the wonderful Revigorator.
Dog. What eventually led to the downfall of internal radium treatment?
People began to discover that in addition to the short-term effects of burns, radium and radioactivity can have long-term health effects, which can be very damaging and potentially fatal. The first time that people publicly had a sense of the dangers of radium was beginning in 1922. This is the beginning of the radium dial painters tragedy. So there were women working in a factory in the US painting radium watches. So if you put radium paint on watches and they glow in the dark, and that's a useful thing to do. And the women were instructed to use their mouths to put a tip on the paintbrush to make sure that it's nice and pointed. And so they ingested the radium paint in appreciable amounts because they're working and painting radium dials. And this is what they're doing for work for hours at a time. And the company should have known better, and because this went on for far too long. But the women working here as the dial painters eventually developed cancers and all sorts of problems in their mouths and jaws and throats, and many of them died painfully after having this exposure to radium. And then specifically with the internal radium therapy, there was one brand of internal radium therapy that you could buy as a patent medicine that was called Radithor. And it came in small bottles, and it was extremely expensive because it actually had a noticeable amount of real radium in it. So this was a company that was not trying to con its consumers and claim that they had radium when they didn't. And it was basically sold from a modern perspective as an energy drink. So it sort of invigorates you and helps you with all sorts of, you know, you feel better and on all sorts of things. And there was a socialite named Eben Byers, and he swore by Radithor. He loved it. He prescribed it for his racehorses, and he was, you know, very popular. He was like in the news and sort of a man about town society person. And he drank so much Radithor so faithfully that it killed him. And this, of course, made the news that he was killed in 1932. So that was definitely the end of any sort of internal radium therapy, things that you would buy as a consumer to drink radium or things like that, because it killed someone very publicly. And there was no question that it was the Radithor that had injured him and killed him.
But that didn't stop external radium therapy.
No, because beginning in the 1910s, external radium therapy was beginning to move into hospitals. And so it was becoming more standardized. It was becoming more of a part of mainstream medicine. So definitely by the 20s and 30s, when these things are happening, that people are learning that drinking radium or ingesting radium is dangerous and potentially fatal. By that point in the 20s and 30s, radium therapy in hospitals had a system and a process. It was in professional hands. So this wasn't something that you were just buying at the store. This was a doctor bringing you a treatment, and it had been studied. And it wasn't something that you were drinking. It was almost a surgical procedure most of the time. And sometimes it was a surgical procedure that, you know, tiny needles or tiny glass pellets containing radon were being injected into the tumor so that with proper shielding. And so that it was basically, they were trying to target the radiation just to cancer cells as much as they could.
What's interesting is the way you explain it. So we're talking the 1910s here. We're seeing the beginnings of modern radiation treatment.
Yeah.
Because brachytherapy is the seeds, and there's shielding and there's dosage. So the modern treatment goes back to the 1910s?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of commonly traced to the Manhattan Project, because radioisotopes that are getting produced from cyclotrons that were used for the Manhattan Project or later for the atomic energy after the war, medical radioisotopes were used for that. So it can commonly get tied to World War II Manhattan Project. But physicians had been using radiation in medicine for decades before then.
Wow. So how did the scientists play a role? How did the physicists play a role in bringing radium into the hospitals?
So they were very important. Physicists and chemists were very important in getting radium into the hands of physicians and into hospitals. Most physicians, when they bought radium salts from the distributor, they didn't have a way of checking like how strong it was. They said, okay, I want radium of this strength. I want this many grams. They got it. And they didn't usually have the lab equipment to test to see if they actually got what they ordered. So a lot of times physicians would partner with a physicist or a chemist at, you know, a university and give them that to test to see. A lot of these radium therapists would also work with university scientists to learn more about the science of radioactivity so they could learn better the distinctions between alpha, beta, and gamma radiation. How do you shield them? Which ones do you want to shield? Which rays do you want to use in therapy? And eventually, physicists started working in hospitals side by side with the physicians, sometimes seeing patients themselves.
Was this the first instance where we have, I guess, what we call today a medical physicist?
It possibly is. And so that's possibly was in 1913, William Duane was hired at the Huntington Memorial Hospital in Harvard. He was potentially the first physicist working in a hospital. And he was hired to install radium emanation plant. And so that is a complicated bit of equipment that is quite large that physicists and chemists had been using in laboratories for a while in their study of radioactivity and was adapted for hospital use to collect radon for use in these small needles or seeds, you know, made out of glass that could be used surgically to treat cancers. And physicians, starting in the 19-teens, were beginning to prefer radon to radium because it has a shorter half-life and it's more easily controlled and more easily, you know, does the job that they want it to do and doesn't stick around for 1,000 years like radium will do. It takes a scientist to like install this equipment and you have to tend to it daily because radium is continually producing radon. And so you've got this really complicated piece of laboratory glassware that's taking radon off the radium and you have to make sure that it's tended to.
What do you consider to be the major turning points in radium therapy?
I think it would be that radium emanation plant. That would be one of the major turning points because that is something that requires collaboration with scientists. It basically requires a hospital setting. One, because it's a large piece of equipment and you have to hire somebody to take care of it who knows what they're doing. It also requires at least a half a gram of radium, which doesn't sound like that much, but that's extraordinarily expensive at the time. That is thousands and thousands of dollars in today's money. So that's not something that a physician in a private practice can have unless he's one of basically two of the private physicians in the United States who had large radium clinics that they were running as small hospitals on their own. So that the radium emanation plant really brought radium therapy into hospitals and made it a more scientific, more controlled, more studied sort of therapy.
This would have been a major investment for a hospital.
Yes. Yes. So they would have needed to have donors or somebody that was committed to paying for this to bring it into the hospital.
But at this point, it was here to stay, radium therapy.
Yeah. And it proved to be effective enough that even after people started using radioisotopes, mainly in the 1940s, some a little bit earlier, radon therapy, they were using hospitals that had radium emanation plants were using that radon up until the 1950s or later.
You had mentioned that cancer was treated by the surgeons before the radium treatment came along. At this point, now that we have these radium clinics now in hospitals, like what did the surgeons think at this point?
There was definitely some pushback and some territorialism from surgeons because they have an established therapy at this point. It works. And if people come in soon enough, it works very well. And there's all sorts of new things being spun out of science. There's radium therapy, there's x-ray therapy, there's electrotherapy, there's ultraviolet light, there's Stinson light. There's like all sorts of these new kinds of waves and radiations and stuff that's coming out of science. And some of them seem like they're working and some of them maybe, you know, are made up, and it's difficult to tell which ones are actually effective and safe. There's definitely some pushback from surgeons. There was about a decade of more or less experimentation from doctors using radium before they could demonstrate that in these specific cases, it can be effective to use radioactivity.
Did it help that the physicist and chemist were working with the doctors on this treatment?
Absolutely. That gave some authority to the scientists, to the doctors that were using this. They had scientists working with them, that they had the authority of physics and chemistry with them, that it wasn't just on some quack and I've, you know, I've read a comic book and I know a little bit about this. Like, no, I have someone else who's credentialed in their well-respected field working with me, and I'm credentialed in my well-respected field of medicine. So that definitely helped as well.
I bet you ran into a lot of interesting characters.
It shouldn't be surprising, but it did surprise me going through the records that there are at least two women who are involved as radium therapists in their own right. So I should say Margaret Cleves worked as a radium therapist, and then Edith Quimby worked as a physicist in a hospital. So not strictly a radium therapist, but she would work with patients. And she did a lot of work sort of developing using water phantoms and things that people will use to like study nuclear medicines today to see, like, if we put the source here, how does that affect this part of the body deep in the tissues here? Like, she would do those studies and that sort of scientific stuff. And I think I shouldn't have gone in with the assumption that this is going to be entirely a male story when looking at the doctors. And it was, of course, largely a male story because it's the beginning of the 20th century. But there were professional women involved with this as well.
I was delighted to see that, actually, because like you, I hadn't expected it. Even looking at the Manhattan Project, which is a couple decades later, there are very few women. So I didn't expect many at the turn of the century. But seeing Edith Quimby talk about so many procedures that we still use today, like you said, the phantom, the practices of calculating doses and the procedures that she had talked about are things that I teach my nuclear medicine technology students now that, again, were developed, you know, 100 years ago. It's fascinating.
And she argued, she spent a lot of her career arguing that this is professional work, that this is not technical work that is in support of another profession. This is in and of itself professional work that deserves respect. And I think that that legacy bears that out, even though she had to fight for that for most of her career, for decades, the fact that we are still using that, and that's the basis of so much nuclear medicine today, like, bears that out, that is professional work, that is, you need to be an expert in that.
Absolutely. It is professional work, because if it was just a technician, then you wouldn't have had to have done any experiments.
Bodies are complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
Early radium therapists struggled with too, is just like, where is the line between having this completely systematized that, like, okay, we know that it's exactly this formula versus adapting it to the individual patient that you're seeing right then? And in the first decade, it was definitely way on the end of the scale of we're going to treat every patient individually, to the point where it was kind of difficult for a physician wanting to get into radium therapy to know what the therapy actually was, because so much of it was just up to the experience of that individual doctor. Like, I've got this patient, I see how they're responding through my own empirical experience. I can see that, like, I think that this is another 20 minutes. That's what we'll take. And then in a week, I'll give you another 20 minutes. And it's sort of standardized, but it takes a good decade for it to get a little bit more towards that. We're using equations, but equations aren't going to tell you everything. You still have to treat every patient as a person.
I think I remember reading at some point that they used to think when they were doing radiation therapy that a patient was done when their skin turned red.
Yeah, that was actually like an accepted measure. It came from X-ray therapy. It was called an erythema dose. So once the skin begins to redden, that's a sign that, okay, that's the end of this dose. That's an indication that this session is done. You come back in a week or a month. There's a lot of problems with that. One, obviously, is that reddening of the skin means that the patient is being burned, and that's not great. Another problem with that is that people have different skin tones, so that erythema will, that reddening of the skin will happen at different times for different people, and it also assumes a light skin tone to begin with, which not all of your patients are going to have. So it's really kind of problematic, and that was one of the things that Edith Quimby was working on with her phantoms and other things was, she still used the term erythema dose, but she was trying to create a standard for it that wasn't just like the skin got red. She was trying to create like a mathematical systematized standard for knowing like what a standard dose was. And then you can adapt from that.
So Edith was instrumental in starting the dose equations and the systematic dosing of patients.
Right.
I never realized where that came from, but someone had to start figuring that out.
And I don't think it was just her, but she was definitely one of the early people that was doing that work and doing that research.
But if you want to be a science, then you have to be able to teach people how to do the therapy. Therefore, you must have some sort of dose calculation.
Right, exactly. And you have to have the scientific establishment of the Curie as a unit in 1910 was enormously helpful for doctors, because then they had a way of telling like how strong the radium salts were that they were using. There was a standard. And for a while, you know, the U.S. government was running a thing where doctors could send their radium samples to be measured against, you know, the U.S. government standard and then sent back. So they knew exactly how strong, how radioactive that sample was.
Did the general public then start seeking help for cancer a little bit earlier now that they knew this alternative treatment was available?
That was definitely the hope of doctors. I don't know. It's really difficult to study that kind of thing to see, like, how many patients were coming in at what time. So I don't know if it had the effect that they were hoping for, but that was definitely one of the hopes of radium therapy, is it would get patients in the door sooner and they would be able to be helped by somebody, whether it was with radium or by surgery.
And I guess cancer wasn't accepted until decades later, so that didn't change either.
Right, yeah, people, it's still scary. I mean, we're not in the same place that we were a century ago, where sometimes doctors wouldn't even tell their patients that they were treating them for cancer because they knew that it would upset them so much. And that wasn't really believed to be a right that the patient had in all cases. But it's definitely something we believe now, that, you know, you have the right to know what you're being treated for, that you have to give consent for this. But a century ago, sometimes doctors in a paternalistic fashion felt like, maybe I'll tell the family, but I'll spare the patient from the news.
Well, I was reading a book about breast cancer in the 1950s, and that was still the way doctors were treating women.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's definitely a gender dynamic to this as well, because one of the main things that radium therapy was being used to treat was gynecological cancers. But there was definitely male doctors treating female patients was a big part of the dynamic in radium therapy.
Did that cause some ethical concerns, at least looking back?
I mean, from our standards, yes. From their standards, no. There was not the same understanding in medicine that's accepted now in terms of consent from patients and what it means to do a clinical trial, if that had a different meaning.
What impact did radium therapy have on today's cancer treatment, or just with the medical world?
Radium therapy is the beginnings of the ways that we use radioactivity in medicine today, like modern radiotherapy. A lot of it comes from radium therapy and the ways that we use medical radioisotopes and other radiation in medicine today. A lot of those techniques came from radium therapy, or came from physicians who were using radium therapy and then adapted that later in their careers when they began using radioisotopes in the 1940s or 50s.
Wow, this was a really important time period then for medicine and for cancer.
Yes, absolutely.
I had always heard every time a new element was discovered, someone had put it on their skin and been like, I've cured cancer. But I didn't know that there was such a procedure around radium that was kind of this base for everything that came after.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of what was, you know, radium therapy was building off of X-ray therapy. But before radium, doctors were using X-rays both the way that we use X-rays today as a diagnostic tool, but they were also using it as a therapy, which is, we know now, radically more dangerous than using radioactivity as a therapy. But they learned from those techniques and adapted those into radium. And then there were things that were using in X-ray therapy that were coming from even earlier therapies. So this is, you know, going back to the 19th century at this point.
That's kind of crazy that medicine moves so quickly.
Yes. Yeah. And is so eager to learn from science. That's a big part of what's happening in radium therapy, is doctors getting excited about things that they're learning from science and wondering, how can we help people with this?
Thank you for listening. You can find more information about us on our website, mynuclearlife.com, including our email and social media details. You can also show us support by rating, reviewing, and subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to this episode. A special thanks to Amy for taking time out to talk to me, and Lexi Weghorn for all of her help with this podcast. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next time when we will discuss another way nuclear science has impacted your life and the world around you. I'm Shelley Lesher, and this has been My Nuclear Life.